You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello, and welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Happy New Year! I trust any hangovers have been recovered from, and you're all up and ready for the challenges that 2021 has in store for us all. After what last year threw at us, perhaps only Bigfoot entering politics would surprise me now. So, for the first episode of the new year, I am delighted to welcome back the mighty Nick Redfern onto the show, to delve into the mysteries of the Red Planet and his latest book, The Martians. Mars has captivated many of us who have an interest in space, ufology, or aliens for as long as we've been aware of its presence. From the claims of canals and alien civilizations being spotted upon its surface, to the discovery of ice caps, claims of alien artifacts being spotted upon its surface, alleged secret NASA programs, we delve into the many mysteries of Mars. Nick also covers a couple of stories from his preceding book, Monsters of the Deep, as we discuss a couple of creepy tales from the London Underground. And as always, it was a pleasure to have Nick return to the show, and I recommend both of his latest books. Congratulations are also in order for a regular guest of the show, Lyle Blackburn, who is the well-deserved recipient of the Bigfooter of the Year Award, run by Daniel Perez and the Bigfoot Times. Congratulations, Lyle. As always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon to get early releases of the regular show, the new series that starts later this month, and much, much more. You can find the link in this week's show notes as usual. We are also on all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Artwork for Mysteries and Monsters, as always, by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, for our first show of 2021, let's take a trip to the Red Planet in the company of Nick Redfern. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, I am delighted to welcome back the ever-popular Nick Redfern, with his two latest books covering both the potential for alien life on our nearest neighbour in the Martians and the fearsome Monsters of the Deep. Nick's books continue to enthrall and absorb us. Nick, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hello, mate. I'm doing good, thanks. How's it going?
Hey, we're all right, you know. We're all doing what we need to do, sir. So, as I'm sure you are too. Yeah, I'm running a bit low on masks, to be honest. So, I might have to invest in some sort of fabric ones. But I've got plenty of scarves if the need arises.
Yeah, I sort of get mine from the local chemist, and they've got, you know, sort of hospital grade, and they're actually really cheap. It's sort of, you get like 10 for about $2 or $3, something like that.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I guess like most people, you know, you just got to be careful, and let's just hope that sooner than later we can put all this behind us, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I concur with that opinion. Well, talking of strange, earth-shattering situations as we currently find ourselves in, The Martians, Nick, is a book that kind of looks at the variety of claims and situations and all kinds of weird and wonderful points in regards to this enigmatic planet that seems to have seduced us for the best part of 200 years.
Oh, you're right. I mean, you know, if you look at the solar system itself, you don't really see a great deal of coverage and people getting all excited and amazed by Mercury, you know, or Saturn.
Yeah.
You know, no disrespect to them, but
yes.
But that is the fact. But Mars is almost completely the exact polar opposite, in the sense that, just, I won't say every day, but certainly, you know, every year, there are multiple sort of anomalies, you know, whether it's photographs or it's a new finding of, you know, an underwater lake or something like this. And, you know, so in other words, there's a lot of really weird stuff surrounding Mars. And what's interesting is that that fascination, if you like, goes back thousands of years. For example, you know, when Mars was perceived as like a deity. So Mars, you know, played a big role in, for example, ancient Roman history, Greek culture, things like that, the Egyptians. So, in other words, you have seen a kind of like an affinity with Mars. And I sometimes wonder, and I mentioned this, I think, in the book, it's almost as if it's like an inherited memory that we all have. We all know that there's some kind of connection between us and Mars, but it's kind of like that situation when you wake up from a dream. It's right there, and then it starts to, in 5-10 seconds, you know, it's gone. And you try and you struggle to get that dream back. But in this case, it's not a dream. But I do think there could well be something like that, something where there was this connection, and maybe there was a Martian civilization. Perhaps at some point the two interacted, which is, you know, a highly controversial thing to sort of talk about. But if that is the case, maybe that affinity, that kind of inherited memory, could, I think, possibly allow for why we do seem to have this fascination with Mars, even though, you know, it is a significant distance away from us anyway. So.
It is interesting. I think when you look back at it, and if anybody's got a love of science fiction, Mars seems to have been the point that kind of kicked off after Giovanni Schiaparelli claimed to spot canals, I think, in the late 1870s. And from that point, you can kind of see that culturally, the possibility about Mars and what it could hold just seems to take off completely from sort of that point, Nick.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's two ways you can look at Mars in terms of its history.
Mm.
One is the scientific work that's been done, you know, to find this and find that. And then you've got the pop culture aspect of Mars, you know, whether it's H.G. Wells, you know, War of the Worlds, that kind of thing. You've got recent movies like The Martian, you know, ones like that. And in between, you know, you've got things like Quatermass and the Pit, and all sorts of movies, novels, you know, the John Carter novels, things like that, comic books. And I think to a degree, you know, these two aspects, if you like, have blended together to where, you know, you can in almost in like an eerie fashion, you can talk about, you know, sci-fi and fantasy novels and movies, but you can actually see a degree of similarity in some of these anomalies that have been photographed on Mars. You know, it's almost as if, you know, what came first, sort of the, you know, the fact or the fiction. Or is it a bit of both?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what I've always found interesting, especially because War of the Worlds is one of my favourite books, and if you had to pin me down on such a label as your favourite concept album, then clearly Jeff Wayne's version of War of the Worlds is still something I listen to this day, Nick, despite the fact of it being over 40 years old. I absolutely adore it, and it, for me, it's the best version of the book that's ever been made into sort of a complete version of it, rather than the films and the TVs always kind of leave me a bit disappointed personally, because I love the book so much. So it's always been very interesting that Wells, even before he wrote War of the Worlds, was clearly considering the possibilities, because I think he wrote an essay sort of pondering the possibility that intelligent life, if it didn't still exist on Mars, could have. And it was almost as if once we'd started to look at the scientific advancement through astronomy and our knowledge of the universe began to increase, Nick, people suddenly automatically began to focus on the potential of life on Mars from that point on.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, one of the important things about all this is that the more we've looked into it, the more we are actually beginning to see the distinct possibilities that what began as sci-fi is now actually sort of spilling over into reality. You know, whether it's, like I mentioned earlier, like somebody finds a new lake, underwater lake, that kind of thing. Somebody takes a picture of what looks like a weird creature on Mars. you put it all together and it's, you know, it's not a surprise, really, that people are now looking at Mars and thinking, well, what the hell is going on there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is, I think the fact that, obviously, from where we were at the end of the 19th century with people thinking that we'd got canals that had been built and people were putting forward the possibility that these were created, and obviously we can now say that they're actually sort of flaws that have left a scar on the surface, or so we're told.
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about, you know, the stories of the canals, which yes, really did have, you know, 100 years ago thereabouts, a lot of people were like, wow, these really could be canals, you know, yeah. Real canals. And we know, you know, that they're not. But what is interesting, and it's almost, again, kind of like fact versus fiction, some of the photographs that came back from Mars in the 1990s showed what looks like these very strange long tubes across various parts of the Martian surface. And if you look at those tubes, that's exactly what they look like. If you look at the pictures, it's difficult to actually sort of figure out the size, and I reproduce one of the NASA pictures in the book. But those tubes, if that's what they are sort of anywhere between 20 and 40 feet wide. So, you know, they're huge, and there's no real sort of clear consensus as to what they are. Now, a number of researchers have suggested some, like a Martian equivalent of the London Underground or the New York subway, that kind of thing. In other words, gigantic tubes allowing for extensive travel across the Martian landscape, maybe, who knows, 10,000 years ago, 50,000 years ago, who knows? So, but it's intriguing, you know, that the canals went away and the tubes have sort of come to the forefront, you know.
Well, it does seem to be, this is the thing about Mars, is every time we seem to put something to bed, you know, we could talk about the anomalies, I would suggest, Nick, for probably the best part of a day. I mean, as you touched on there, one of my favourite pictures that's classed as one of the Martian anomalies is this mysterious figure, primarily because it always reminded me of the way the Bigfoot looks back in the Patterson-Gimlin film. So everybody's going, oh, it looks like a man and a woman, and I was thinking, well, actually, it looks a bit like Bigfoot to me. So it just seems that every time we sort of put one mystery to bed, be it, you know, the canals or the face on Mars or numerous other ones, like you say, things like the tubes turn up and you're like, what on earth are these now?
Well, you're right, and I mean, you can find, and the fact is, you know, you can find a lot of different anomalies. If it was just one thing, I think yes, a lot of people wouldn't be so excited. But, you know, when you've got, like, as you said, this sort of statue-like thing, and got the tubes, and you've also got what eerily look like trees and bushes that have become known as the banyan trees, B-A-N-Y-A-N. And again, I reproduced one of those in the book, and you know, NASA's response to this, that they think it's just, like, extensive ice particles. Now, if you look at the photographs, and as I said, I reproduced one, but there's dozens of them, you know, that have actually been taken. To me, it kind of looks like somebody has taken a photograph out of an aircraft flying over somewhere like Arizona, where it's all bleak and, you know, there's a few bushes and trees here and there. That, to me, is what it looks like. Now, they don't look like any kind of trees that you would see on Earth, but you would not expect, you know, for another world to be, you know, exactly identical to like an oak tree or whatever, you know, in here. But they still look like visible as a tree or a bush. Now, if they are bushes and trees or one of the other on Mars and you've got running water, then there's a good chance for life. I mean, water, if there's trees, there's bushes, that suggests that even right now that Mars is not a dead world. You know, it might be in a bad state compared to our world. But if you've got bushes and trees that can survive, and we know there's running water now, not just at the ice caps, then that, you know, sort of really does open, you know, your eyes to a significant degree. And now, it's one thing to talk about bushes and trees and things like that, but when it comes to, you know, sort of animal life, that's a whole different angle. And of course, this also comes back to the anomalies. One of the things, again, that I reproduce in the book is a photograph that's become known as the facehugger picture.
Yes.
And which is really weird. It's called that because, for people who may not know, one of the Martian rovers took a photograph of this strange-looking thing. Well, before I get to what it actually is, the picture was taken by one of the Mars rovers, and it shows something which appears to be sort of a crawling up a wall of a cave or down it. And it's called the facehugger picture because it closely sort of parallels the imagery of the facehuggers in the Aliens movies with Miss Sigourney Weaver. You know, if you've seen the movies, I'm sure you have, you know, you've got this fast running scuttling thing, you know, that grabs you in the face and whatever. Now, I mean, for me, it's an anomaly because it's hard to explain what it is. It doesn't actually look like a piece of rock or a piece of stone. It really does look like sort of a circular thing with eight limbs coming off it. Now, I'm not saying that 100% that that's what it is, but if you look at it, it's hard to reconcile what else actually could it be. How could a piece of rock look like that, like a circular piece with eight limbs, if you like, all around it? So, you know, it does make me wonder if that is a Martian. You know, I guess if we're thinking about Martians, we're thinking, you know, coming face to face with something like us. But I mean, maybe one of a surviving indigenous entity on Mars, you know, could it be something like that, something like the facehuggers? You know, that would be particularly good for us if when we visit there and we find not friendly Martians, but, you know, tens of thousands of facehuggers coming over the hill, you know. But joking aside, I mean, it is hard to say what that picture is. I mean, for me, it would be really cool if they could sort of direct the rover to go back to that exact area and see if it's still the same. Then I'd say, well, yeah, it probably is just some weird piece of rock. But if it's gone, well, you know, you've made a case that it's real because it's not there anymore. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a very unusual image, regardless of how you view it, Nick, be it, is it some kind of facehugger? I mean, even if you consider the possibility it's a plant, that alone is that takes the whole conversation to a different level. And because, once again, that is a sign of life. A lot of these things are said, well, it's just pareidolia. But when you look at that image, it is just remarkable because, like you say, that would take an exceptional set of circumstances for a natural phenomenon to cause that. Now, I'm you know, I'm not going to say, oh, well, it proves that there's something strange going on. But it is such, it's one of the more unnerving images that have come from Mars. Because sometimes you can see stuff and you're just like, well, it depends. You know, like we were saying about the figure, that story blew up until it came out that what we were actually looking at was sort of tiny images. Whereas I think a lot of people were promoting, oh, it's a man walking about the surface of Mars. But, well, it's tiny. It's about a toy soldier size, I think you refer to it in the book, Nick. But when you see it, I mean, one of the things it reminds me of is a petroglyph. It looks like cave art.
It does, really, you're right.
So, I mean, that chapter, when you're looking at some of the images, I mean, the other fantastic one is on the following page, which is the king and his crown, Nick.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, everybody, you know, when you think about the anomalies on Mars, everybody thinks like the face on Mars, as it's known. But for me, there's a far more impressive image, and that's one of what's become known as the crowned face. And a lot of people don't know about that particular one, but it's in what's called the Libia Montes area of Mars. And if you look again, now this is one not from one of the, for the listeners, this is not one of the images taken by the rovers. This was actually taken in orbit by one of NASA's craft. Now if you look at it, it's called the crowned face because it kind of looks like this carving of a face with a crown. And if you look at it, you've got two eyes, even with pupils, and you can see the pupil better in the left eye. You've got a nose, with two nostrils, lips, and it almost looks like it's got a dimpled chin as well, which is very... When you look at it, and for me, that doesn't look like pareidolia. I mean, it could be, you know. I mean, we've all seen like a shadow that, or a cloud that kind of looks like something else. You know, somebody sees a picture of Elvis in a cup of coffee or whatever, you know. But it clearly actually isn't, but it really looks like him, you know. But the fact is, we've seen all these anomalies on Mars, and that's the important thing. And for me, but the crowned face one is a really fascinating one, and to have all those aspects of a face looking just how it should look, apart from the fact that probably over 10, 20, 30, 40,000 years, who knows, that it's been battered, as you would expect. However, even in that the situation, it still looks impressive. And again, you know, it's not like we're coming back from, you know, sort of some of the old probes, like, for example, like Pluto, Uranus, or wherever. But we're seeing it with Mars, and that's one of the things that interests me. You know, there's so many mysteries on Mars, but there's so less mysteries on the other worlds. And again, that makes me wonder if, next to us, you know, that Mars is pretty unique.
Yeah. I mean, I've often, for me, I can look at pictures of the Martian surface for hours, Nick, just taking it all in, because once, especially in this day and age, what we see now compared to what we grew up with as kids, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, it's like a different world these days. The quality of the imagery, and I never expected us to have a camera on the surface of Mars whilst I was still alive, Nick, with the greatest respect. You know, I never thought I'd see that happen. And to see and know what we know now, I remember the image of the Dust Devil that was captured, and I was just blown away by that, because when you see something like that and you know it's on another planet, it just, for me anyway, it just blows my mind. Even though, you know, it's a fairly mundane natural phenomenon, Nick, we're seeing this on an alien planet.
You're right, and I mean, when you think, you know, that the sheer distance, you know, distance from here. I mean, for example, unlike, you know, our world, which has sort of, you know, the same orbit around the sun, Mars is very different, and its orbit actually differs wildly. But the average distance is 140 million miles away, which is, it's almost impossible to figure out what that is. You know what it is, but to actually try and understand in your mind how far that actually really is, and the fact that we actually have made it there and landed craft successfully, taken pictures, and have these little things just trundling across the landscape for all, you know, as long as they've got fuel going or can keep going. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have made major advances in that respect. You would never think you could do all of those different aspects of the mission and have it all successfully work.
Yeah, yeah. It is mind-blowing, really, to see what we've achieved. Because it, especially over the last 10 years, Nick, it seems like there's a real momentum in regards to Mars as well. Because clearly NASA and other governments around the world see a lot of potential here, be that for the long-term aim of colonizing it, which in itself, you know, is once again one of those things that I grew up as a kid. I remember seeing the Martian Chronicles on TV about the first human contact on Mars, and they end up interacting with the population, and things don't go quite to plan, unsurprisingly. But to now be on a cusp where people are actually talking about this, Nick, and not being laughed at or ridiculed, it's taken extremely seriously. It's incredible that there just seems to be such a momentum in regards to the potential to move there.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it'd be great if we had sort of a second world. but I guess the big downside on all this is, you know, it's one thing to send a small probe or something a little bit bigger than a lawnmower, you know, to take pictures or whatever. I mean, that in itself is a big, impressive development. But to actually sort of, as they call it, terraform, you know, the planet and give it an amenable atmosphere and, you know, grow bushes, trees, I think it could be done, but I think that would take so long because, I mean, if you think of our planet right now, let's say that you're living in the middle of London and you've got to terraform not just London, but the entire planet, every country. You look at it from that perspective, I think while it could be done, you know, it's feasible, I think it would take so long to actually alter the atmosphere and the ground of an entire world. I think that would take a long, long time. But just because it's a long time doesn't mean it cannot be achieved, you know. So I think, you know, I mean, if we could change it and have another world, but knowing us, the human race, you know, there'd be rivals between this world and that world, and we'd probably go to war with the other one anyway.
You'd end up going to war with ourselves, Nick, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, it's almost like, you know, the Earth people versus the Martians, but we're actually the same people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure there'd be some way they'd be able to tell the difference. But, I mean, the potential is there now. Like I say, I think Elon Musk this week was talking once again. He's setting a date for when he expects the first people to be living there, which, like I say, you know, well, good luck to him. I think he's being a little over-optimistic, if I'm honest, because what do you think, Nick?
Well, I tell you, Mark, I mean, I think what he's doing is a great idea. Well, ideas, I should say. And, you know, he's one of these people who's like a pioneer and someone who's got the impetus and the enthusiasm. And you need all of that. And the important thing is that he has all that. I think for me, the one big downside on all of this is actually nothing to do with him or his plans or anything like that. I think more than anything else, the problem is going to be the psychological aspect on the crew. Now, you know, I mentioned that the average distance to Mars is 140 million miles. Now, let's say we get a craft, you know, that's, I mean, 10 years ago, they were saying, well, it's going to take us, you know, 7 or 8 years to get there and 7 or 8 years to get back. Now they're talking about 2 to 3 years. Now, if you were able to build a significantly big enough craft to go to Mars and it took 2.5 years, and let's say the astronauts, let's say there's 5 or 6 of them on board, and they spend up to 6 months on the planet doing as much research as they can, and then they've got another 2.5 year flight back. That's like 4 to 5 years.
Mm.
Now, it's one thing to have like a mock-up out in the desert,
yeah,
and, you know, growing potatoes and peas and who knows what else, you know, to keep you going.
Mm.
That's one thing. Psychologically, you know that you can go home at the end of the day and have a plate of fish and chips with your wife,
yes,
you know. But when, for example, you're actually so far away from the Earth that it just looks like a star, you mm. know, if you think about it now, today's astronauts, when they're in space, what's the biggest thing that dominates the sky when they're in Earth orbit? Well, it's the Earth.
Mm.
But no astronaut has ever gone into space and realized that they cannot see the Earth anymore.
Mm.
You know, they may not even know, you know, so far out that you're not even sure where it is anymore.
Mm.
So my concern would be more about the astronauts, not the technology or the craft. I mean, that kind of thing can be done. But if you've got, let's say, 6 or 7, 8 astronauts, and even if it's a big enough one to allow them, you know, to at least get around the place and exercise and have, you know, hundreds of Blu-rays and everything to keep
yes.
them going. But in saying that, you know, I mean, going out, I'm not sure, even if they've trained for it, I'm not sure what the effects would be of just looking out of windows for 5 years, you know, and just seeing a few, well, not a few, but a lot of dots of stars.
Mm.
And that's it. And, you know, what if something goes wrong? Like, let's say that, you know, that obviously need a medical expert. What if the medical expert, him or herself, dies?
Yeah.
That kind of situation. What, one of the crew just goes crazy because, I mean, I might go crazy after 5 years
mm.
sitting in something, you know, like the size of a bedsit. You know, no disrespect to anybody who lives in a bedsit.
Yeah.
I've lived in bedsits,
yes,
and, you
yeah.
know, and they're small. But, you know, I can say for sure, you know, having lived in one, that, you know, they're small.
Mm.
You imagine being in a bedsit for 5 years, looking out of a window at just stars, and then having to come back. I think the big problem is not getting to Mars or finding, you know, amazing new discoveries, which I'm sure we would. I think the big stumbling block is the crew.
Mm.
That's it, really.
Yeah, and I think that is something that often gets overlooked, because even in the last 12 months, Nick, they've said to things, well, it's a one-way ticket, because, you know, and you have to... I've always had an interest in space travel. I'm no expert or anything, but as someone that saw the, you know, the shuttles peak during the 80s and having them, you know, we'd all go into the assembly hall at school and watch them take off and come home. It's something I've always had a real interest in. So the first thing on top of everything else is the size of the rocket that you would need to get a substantial payload there on top of, you know, everything else that you're talking in regards to the psychological and physical effects that it would have on the astronauts, Nick. I think these things don't get taken into consideration, because the other thing is, well, how, if it gets there, how are they going to land? And also, well, that's great if they're going to land there, but surely it's either the rocket's either got to land and have enough fuel to come back, which makes it even bigger, which possibly is impossible in the current technological situation,
well,
Nick. Or what?
Well, you're right. And the other angle, of course, is food. Now, if you've seen the movie The Martian,
yes.
with what's his name?
Matt Damon.
Yeah, Matt Damon, you know, and he finds a way, you know, he's pretty much living on just potatoes, but, you know, but he's keeping him alive. Now, if you think about it, let's say you've got, let's say, 8 astronauts on the craft, and each one of them, to stay healthy, has to have breakfast, lunch and dinner.
Mm.
So 8, you know, and 3 meals, that's 24 meals a day.
Yep.
Now, that's 24 meals in one day, that's 240 in 10 days, 2,400 meals in 100 days, and you've got to go for 5 years. I mean, where's all this food going to come from?
You cannot
live, you know, on oatmeal and just on slush.
Yeah.
Because that's not going to keep you going for 5 years. So, I mean, you'd need like a warehouse to put all that, you know, like frozen meals and things like that for 5 years. I mean, the astronauts who went to the moon, they were okay because, you know, the food they had, well, nobody's going to starve on a mission that really wasn't long at all.
Mm.
But to do 5 years round trip or even a 3 year round trip, I mean, the sheer amount of food you would need is incredible. And I just don't see, you know, but again, that comes down to us, the human factor. Mm-hmm. It's either we go crazy or we need food. There's always something that, you know, we are the most, I suppose, the most intelligent thing on the planet, but we're also quite a vulnerable species. You know, a lot of animals can live out in the wild at night, you know, in the winter. I mean, we'd freeze to death, you know, that kind of thing. They can live on cooked meat or, you know, just raw meat. You know, you try eating a piece of a raw steak, you know, you'd be throwing up for days. So my view is that although it would be great to send astronauts to Mars, and the human factor would be a great one because you don't have to program anything, you know, your mind, let's do this, let's go over there. But in saying that, I still think unless something radically massive changes, like, you know, they find a new system which allows us to get to Mars in like 8 weeks, that would not be a problem. But anything over, I think, over a year, either way, is going to have so many stumbling blocks. And I think right now, I think we should focus still on even more highly advanced rovers.
Yeah.
And you know, and I almost have like a battalion of them, you know, going over the hills here and there, you know, and do it that way until we really reach that point of being able to just get there, like I said, in, you know, fortnights or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, maybe even the possibilities, rather than jumping so far forward that you're talking about colonization, you know, even before we get to that point, surely robotics has a part to play in this, not just necessarily in regards to the rovers, Nick, but surely if you're going to try and create an environment that's hospitable in the slightest, it would make more sense to have it built from Earth, as it were, by using robots. But I suppose, I mean, once again, you would then have to comprehend with, can we send fully functioning robots 140 million miles to Mars and then be able for them to start doing what's required?
Yeah. Well, again, you know, that sort of, you know, I think we could program things okay, but, you know, if something happened and it tipped over or whatever, you haven't got the guy next to you who can just pick you up, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, then there's the totally different angle, which is the highly controversial angle as well, namely that we have gone there, you know, the so-called secret space program,
yep.
You know, that kind of thing. Now, I didn't sort of overly talk about that in the book, because a lot of it is sort of speculative. But one of the things that interests me about the whole, you know, the idea of a secret space program, on the one hand, you know, people would say, well, there's no way, you know, that could happen, that NASA runs everything. There isn't, you know, the idea for some people that NASA doesn't even know that there is, like, you know, a secret space program that is, you know, light years, centuries in front of what NASA's doing. You know, that sounds almost, there's just no way that would happen. But the one thing that does make me think there could be a possibility of doing that and hiding it from us, if you look at, let's say, from the end of the Second World War, if you look at the massive advances in science, in, for example, computers, things like that, you know, if you look at science, computers, aircraft technology, medical treatments and new concepts, all of these have sort of radically, you know, gone forward in leaps and bounds, you know, from the 40s to right now. You know, I mean, if you look at the size of computers in the early 50s, you know, they were like the size of a Ford Escort or whatever. Yes. I don't know if they still make Ford Escorts in the UK anymore, but it was the first one that came to mind. And now, you know, we've got phones which we can just do just about anything we want to do on our phones. So all of these aspects of science and technology have jumped forward in leaps and bounds, whether it's medicine, whether it's science, whether it's, you know, technology like computers and phones. All of these have radically gone ahead at, you know, full speed. But when it comes to leaving the planet, we're still using the same sort of brute force chemical rockets that we were using to send Armstrong to the moon. And so the one thing that makes me suspicious that there could be a secret space program is, why is it that in every one of all these other disciplines in science and technology have advanced so much, but as I said, with rocketry, it's still rocketry, you know. You know, it's sort of, like I said, brute force, rockets, flames coming out. Why is it that this one, this aspect, hasn't really advanced? I mean, it's advanced, obviously, but it's still the same concept. You know, it's chemical rockets. And so that makes me think, well, maybe there actually has been the development in the same way that there's been all the other stages of development in science, in biology, and everything else. So that makes me wonder that yes, somebody has achieved this, and maybe that is the case, and maybe that's why there are people within government or the military or whoever aren't at any great importance that they've got to do this. Well, maybe the reason why they're not sort of, you know, really over enthusiastic is because they've already achieved it, but for reasons that they don't want to tell us. Now, if it was just the case that, you know, they wanted to not tell us because, you know, they happened to find a face hugger, you know, I don't believe that if, you know, if NASA or any other agency went to Mars and they found a bunch of face huggers running across the desert, that wouldn't, I don't see any reason to hide that. I mean, no. That would be an amazing development,
yeah.
You know, revelation. It'd be amazing. But in saying that, if there was something that had a radical angle on our world, you know, if there was some sort of connection, then that might be a reason to hide all this. You know, and the only thing I can think of would be if it had an impact on our society. You know, finding a face hugger on Mars is not going to, you know, sort of have people run into bunkers or, you know, yes, hiding under the bed. You know, it's, nobody's going to be worried about a 140 million mile away face hugger. People would be fascinated by it, but they wouldn't be worried, and it wouldn't affect society. Now, some researchers have suggested that perhaps there was a Martian civilization and their world, you know, whether through nuclear war or something, you know, ecological destruction, made their way to the Earth, and against the odds, maybe they even survived and were perceived as like gods. Well, what if, you know, an agency has suspects that is the case? How would you tell the people of Earth that there aren't any gods, but there are the ancient ancestors of Martians? And I don't see how any nation could say that to the world, that, sorry, religion is based on Martians. And I don't think that is actually an out of the picture scenario. I think that is a possibility. And so I think there could have been findings at some point, presuming, of course, that there is a secret space program. I do sometimes wonder if somebody has found something that has a could have a profound effect on worldwide civilization. And so they've decided to do the easiest thing. And what's the easiest thing to do in any life? Just brush it away, or, you know, ignore it. And I think that could be one possibility.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that opens all kinds of points there, Nick, because there has been a consistent number of people over the years that have proposed that we are originally from Mars. Whether you believe in panspermia, or you believe that the fallen gods across all civilizations were actually Martians who came to Earth to save themselves through interplanetary conflict, which has often been proposed as a reason for why Mars is the state it is now. And, you know, there were numerous people who claimed that in the Mars defending itself, it blew up another planet, which is why we've got the asteroid belt. So these are theories that people have ruminated on for generations, Nick, because I think for some people, that makes a lot of sense, because, like you say, you can look at various religions going back before the days of Christ. You know, you look at the stories of Gilgamesh, which I know you touch on in your book as well. There are legends of mystical giants there, and every other major religion and civilization throughout time has this kind of concept of giants or sky gods.
Well, you're right, and I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is this sort of lesser known issue of how in the 1980s the CIA ran a number of remote viewing programs on Mars, and they actually decided to go on a period roughly around 1 million years BC. And now, why they chose that date, we don't know, and why they actually put the program into place in the first place, we don't know. Doesn't matter where you work, you know, in the world, and particularly like at the CIA, you don't get up in the morning and think to yourself, oh, I think I'm going to remote view the planet Mars today. You know, there would have to be a reason as to why they did that. Now, if you read the transcripts of the first of the remote viewing operations of Mars in 1984, and we know there's more, and they haven't been released yet, and we don't know why either. But the one file that we do have, it actually talks about the remote viewers seeing the Martians with their world, you know, in sort of in turmoil, with the atmosphere on fire and, you know, volcanoes and earthquakes and the planet going off its orbit, you know, kind of like a really, like a real Armageddon kind of situation. And the remote viewers talked about seeing these Martians fleeing into these gigantic underground bunkers. And what's interesting, they described the Martians looking pretty much like us, with slight differences, but pretty much like us, except for one thing. The remote viewers, the CIA's remote viewers, talked about the Martians being about 10 to 12 feet tall, you know, which would be really imposing to see somebody looking pretty much like us, but 12 feet high. Now, is it possible, you know, going back to your point, is it possible that the Martians, if they were giants and they got to Earth, well, maybe they were the giants of, you know, like the Old Testament, or with Gilgamesh, Goliath, things like that. Were they actually not deities, gods, nothing of a biblical nature, just another intelligent race trying against all the odds to fight to save its civilization, and eventually, you know, a significant portion of them having to leave the planet and make it to our world. Now, if they were able to do that, they would have to be incredibly close to us, you know, to deal with our atmosphere, pressures, everything else. But, you know, maybe it could be done.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at it, Mars as it is now, Nick, it's got polar ice caps. So you would already look at that and say, well, the potential for it being a similar kind of planet in its heyday, whenever that was, and however it met its untimely demise, because one of the things that we've discovered is, especially in the way that the Earth, or Mars quakes, and, you know, use the term earthquake, but obviously it's in Mars. So Mars quakes, obviously, that was something that changed a lot of scientists' perceptions about how old old Mars was, because I think they were under the impression that it was an Earth-like planet. But when they measured the Mars quakes, they realised that they resonated in a similar way to the ones on the Moon, which would show that the surface is very weak and breaks up easy, Nick, whereas ours is more tectonic-based.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So it would be interesting that, you know, if it... I don't suspect it's that much of a leap in regards to it. When you start to consider the, you know, the concepts of panspermia, especially because it has been used in regards to several things. You know, I've seen it as an excuse for Venus flytraps, for octopus. So, because when we come across something that's so unusual and it just doesn't seem to fit in, it is remarkable when you look at evolution and when it started. Maybe that's why they went for that 1 billion years BC, because they were kind of working on the principle, Nick, that perhaps that's when things began here. And is it that primordial soup of evolution that was kick-started by an interplanetary visitation, whether it be a crashed meteor or somebody escaping an apocalyptic scenario on their home planet?
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily realise how kind of, you know, fragile nature can be. I mean, we look at our world now. I mean, who would have thought a year ago, if somebody said to you a year ago, you know, it'll be dangerous to go outside and, you know, you'll have to wear masks and all the pubs are going to be shut down, you know, and this is going to be shut down. And you'd say, what a year, just a year from now, people would think you were crazy. And if you go back just to 1918, a lot of people, you know, forget or maybe don't know. You know, we had Spanish flu, which killed tens of millions of people right on the back of the First World War, which also killed, you know, a massive amount of, I won't say soldiers, because a lot of them were just kids, you know, sort of bullied into having to go into war. And that was a pointless war anyway. But if you think about it, you know, First World War, right on the back of that, you've got Spanish flu, 30 million or thereabouts killed from that virus. You know, nature is like very lethal and ruthless and can happen very quickly. I mean, the dinosaurs ruled the earth way longer than we ever will. But even they couldn't, you know, they didn't survive it. You know, their time came. And without sounding, you know, grim, but the fact is that they eventually, you know, they did, they went out, they went down. And so, in other words, the same could happen to us. And then, you know, you could have another cycle 20, 30,000 years from now, and the people who are around then will still have remnants of old legends of these people like us who could take to the sky and fly around and things like this, you know. And we'd be forgotten, you know. We'd be like Atlantis. People, you know, 50,000 years from now would sort of, no, there was nobody before us, we're the first, that kind of thing, you know.
You only have to look at natural disasters, Nick, to see just how fragile things can be. You know, in the last 15 years, we've had two devastating tsunamis. You know, the Boxing Day of 2004, I think it was, and then obviously the Japanese one in 2011. And yet, on a scale of interplanetary situations, they're quite minor, because you look at some of the asteroid marks that are still on the planet, Nick, and you consider the possibility of one, you know, if something like that hit the Earth now, there's no telling what kind of damage it could do. And we're very fortunate that perhaps the biggest one we've had in the modern era was Tunguska, which fortunately hit somewhere where nobody was, other than, you know, a few reindeer herders, probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that hit sort of like, you know, straight in the middle of London, I mean, millions would be dead today. You know, and they literally would not know what hit them. Well, you would, because I'm sure they would, they'd be able to calculate to a degree where, roughly enough, you know, where it was going to hit. But, I mean, the sheer damage that would cause, I mean, it would be, it would take hundreds of years probably to recover. you know, in certain areas. And maybe something like that, you know, happened with Mars. I mean, nothing lives forever, you know, and that could be the case with Mars, that whether they had some, you know, I'm speculating now, but if there was a Martian civilization, I think there's a good argument can be made that there was, and maybe there still is. Maybe those bunkers that the CIA saw, maybe they're still there deep underground, and maybe the Martians are still there, you know, hiding from us, you know, keeping watch for every time we send one of these probes or whatever. So I think if you look at it from that perspective, the chances of not having calamities and having to make, you know, sudden changes, whether it's fleeing the world or et cetera, it's very difficult to sort of, I guess, to figure what it would be like when we never really lived through that. I mean, it's bad enough now, but at least we can still say in our own homes. But, you know, something where it's a worldwide disaster, I mean, it would be almost impossible, you know, to sort of get back to any high degree of civilization quickly. I mean, it would just be a nightmare, isn't it?
Well, exactly, and I think it just proves often that we sometimes seem to be oblivious to how tenuous our grip on life actually is, Nick, because anything, you know, in the universe, you know, there are so many unknowns out there. We've no idea if something's on its way here now as we talk. I know this is like, it's a very grim part of the conversation, but I think it is something that for a lot of us the comprehension it's beyond the realms of actually sort of focusing on that kind of issue, Nick, regardless, because even if we were aware of something on its way here, we probably don't have the faculty to actually deal with it in a safe manner.
No, and I mean, you know, I think if you see, like, which one was it, Armageddon with Bruce Willis, that one?
Yes.
I mean, I think the idea that we could actually, you know, but sending the troops and blast an asteroid out of the sky, you know, I mean, that's okay for Hollywood, but I'm not, you know, sure that would actually would work. Movies are very good at having the heroes and everything's cool at the end and the guy gets the girl, you know. But that's movies, you know. That's not the real world. As we're seeing now, you know, we're struggling, you know, with the whole situation right now. I mean, it's slightly off, well, it's significantly off track with Mars, but the fact is, you know, what we're getting now with the whole pandemic, you know, you've got people struggling for money, for food, people losing their jobs, you know, people developing, like, psychological conditions just through stress and anxiety, and how civilization or society, just in the UK alone, I mean, well, as you know as well, I may have left, you know, the UK 23-24 years ago, but I know what a fun night it is to go down the pub on a Friday night.
Yes.
And now you have to be really careful. Who would have thought that? And you put all these issues together, you know, such radical changes can cause massive issues to people, you know, to society. And maybe, you know, if you think of that's just one thing, and if you've got sort of something like an asteroid strike or something like that could have hit Mars, I mean, you put all that together, I mean, you could easily see how even a highly advanced civilization could sort of go down the drain.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't take much, like you say. If we had, you know, as you say, a Tunguska incident on its own, Nick, if that hit London, yeah, it would wipe a city off the face of the earth, but it's the ramifications of, you would have the fallout from the explosion, you would have the ramifications of millions of people either dead or refugees. It would just, the knock-on effect would be incredible, and that you could apply that scenario to any major city in the world.
Yeah, you're right, and the other thing, it's all of this could happen very quickly as well. It doesn't have to be sort of like a long drawn out situation where we can deal with this or deal with that. I mean, you know, something could just, the pandemic now, I mean, pretty much, you know, we start into the start of this year, you know, we had all these rumors coming out of China and things like this, and then by April, everybody was kind of in lockdown.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So these kind of things, you know, radical changes in society and civilization and the planet itself can occur very, very quickly. And maybe, you know, based on what the CIA saw, you know, in the remote viewing, that could be a perfect example of something just overwhelming in a planet and a civilization in not much time at all. And that's the result, I guess.
I think one last thing I want to touch on in regards to the Martians book, Nick, is the wonderful section where we talk about the problems with other countries' satellites around Mars. Because they seem to keep having accidents, and there's a train of thought that NASA are responsible for this.
Well, there's sort of two... Well, actually, there's several approaches to this. Yeah, I talk about this in an entire chapter in the book, where, you know, you have some of these probes, American and Russian probes, either going wrong or getting lost, or they're just plain gone, you know, or the communications have gone. Certainly more within the conspiracy theorists' fields rather than straightforward sort of Martian anomalies. You know, you've got these theories that some of these missions have been sort of derailed. Mm. Now, the big question is who's doing the derailing. Now, there's been, for example, we know for sure that, you know, America has lost a number of probes, as have the Russians, and, you know, so it's no surprise that, you know, this theory that some of these craft could have been, as I said, derailed in some way or another. Now, the big question is, well, who's doing it? And I've heard everything from it's the Russians or it's vice versa, you know, trying to get first. Yeah. Or it's, you know, that one agency doesn't want another agency of another nation to know what the other one's found. And so, you know, they destroy the craft to prevent them from, you know, showing the photographs they found. And so what we're going to do? Well, just derail it, you know. Have it sort of just spiral down through the atmosphere and burn up, and whatever's left is going to end on the surface of Mars anyway, and no one's going to be able to find it at all. So there's a lot of theories as to, you know, who's doing this. And I mean, for me, one of the most intriguing theories is that if there really is sort of vestiges of an ancient Martian civilization still on the planet, deep underground, maybe managed to survive to a fair degree, and maybe a significant degree now, maybe the last thing they would want is to have an intruding civilization from another world come into their world. Well, maybe it's the Martians. You know, maybe it's like the equivalent with Roswell, that maybe the Martians didn't even know about us until one of their probes crashed on their world, and they had their own Roswell incident, you know. And so they're like, oh my God, we've got to do something, you know, there's something else out there. And that is kind of an interesting scenario, you know, that the Martians may actually not have realized that there was somebody else. You know, they could be having the same debates as us. I wonder if there's a life on another world, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Well, maybe they found out when a probe went wrong, or they shot it out the sky. And so, I mean, all these theories are sort of fascinating when it comes to, you know, this particular issue. But what it does come down to is that there have been, you know, a significant number of very weird and odd anomalies when it comes to these failures.
I remember the European Space Agency one. Was that called Schiaparella as well, in honour of him, the Schiaparella satellite? Am I getting that? Or the probe, or whatever. And that one, I think that one just plummeted to the Martian surface, didn't it? Everything was going fine until it got there, and then it just crashed.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it just literally, like, dropped like a stone. And there was theories and, you know, sort of trying to figure out what happened, but it was never really sort of fully resolved. And to me, that makes perfect sense. If something's going to come into your airspace,
yes,
even if you're... civilization may not be as advanced or, you know, as as good as our world, but they still had the ability, you know, mm-hmm. to protect their world and their people. Well, you can't blame them if they just suddenly slammed down onto our world and you're like, holy crap, what was that? You know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, there's, you know, from their perspective, national security issues and... mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot to think about, you know, when it comes to Mars and, you know, these issues of life on Mars, of photographs of ancient, what look like ancient structures on Mars and, you know, carved faces and things like this, and the water and the banyan trees, and, you know, put all this together. And I honestly do believe that a very good case can be made that Mars has some sort of civilization, some sense of survival, and probably a fair amount of secrecy because of what the revelations might actually be.
Mm. Would you say, when you started out writing the book, Nick, has your opinion been swung more towards that because of everything you've seen and everything you've uncovered? Or was that perhaps something you'd always entertain the possibility of?
Well, I mean, you only have to sort of see one or two anomalies to say, well, that's weird. You know, I mean, yeah. A good example that we haven't touched would be like the monoliths that
yes.
have been seen on Mars and on Phobos, which
yeah.
is one of Mars's moon.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd bring that up, you know, when you've got all these monoliths popping up around the
yeah,
world.
Yeah, at the minute, yeah, everywhere.
Which is in itself is interesting.
Yes.
You know, it's one of these situations where, you know, I think that all of these issues, you know, I guess to start with at least, you know, just one or two anomalies was enough for me. But the more I dug into it, you know, and you see the banyan trees and you've got what it's called the Twin Peaks pyramid type structures as well, one of which even looks like a sphinx.
Yes.
and, you know, so when, you know, when you've got things like that and another anomaly comes along and another, I think you... Certainly for me, you know, I reached a peak where this cannot all just be down to coincidence. I mean, one of the things that a lot of people just don't necessarily realize or haven't thought of, you know, when people say, well, these anomalies, you know, it really is just pareidolia, you know, seeing faces in clouds.
Yeah.
Now, my argument is, if it's just pareidolia, why is it that all of these anomalies seem to parallel Egyptian sort of you know, culture? If you look at, for example, Roman civilization, the Greeks, you know, they had their own very distinct architecture,
yep.
as did the Romans. So if this is just pareidolia, why is it that all of these anomalies, most of these anomalies on Mars, why is it that it mirrors Egyptian architecture? And the fact is, most of it does. You've got like the Sphinx, which looks like a Sphinx. You've got these pyramids, which look ancient and damaged, but still look like pyramids. You've got the Twin Peaks. You've got this the Sphinx type structure near the Twin Peaks. Why is it that they, if it's, like I said, if it's all pareidolia, why is it it all resembles ancient Egyptian culture? Why is it that we're not getting to see, like, in steppe pyramids that you find in, like, Central and South America? We're not. So that kind of suggests to me, and granted this is getting controversial, but some sort of connection between Mars and Egypt, you know, which again opens another can of worms then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe the monoliths are actually needles, Nick.
Well, yeah, I mean, that could be.
Would certainly fit into that kind of architecture a bit more, wouldn't it?
But it's a lot of questions, and actually we have got, you know, a number of answers if you view it the answers as potentially sort of hypothetical as well, I suppose.
Absolutely. Well, it is one of those books that whenever you read a chapter, Nick, you just think, right, I want to find out more about these people and these subjects. So it's one of those books that just makes you want to read a lot more about it. So it's a fantastic collection.
Yeah, well, thanks. Cheers, mate.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. So, thanks. Quickly, before I let you escape back to your city, in our lockdown lifestyles, your preceding book is also equally marvellous, Nick, which was Monsters of the Deep, which was something that I'd been looking forward to once I'd heard you were releasing it, because if there's one thing I love, it's monsters, primarily of all ilks. Now, this book isn't what I was expecting at all, Nick, because it is such a vast collection of different subsections, and I think, you know, the presumption on my part was probably, oh, we're just going to talk about what you would perceive to be the normal sea monster or lake monster, but this book just goes in all kinds of different areas and different types of monsters. So was that something that just kicked off, Nick, or did you have an idea that that's what you wanted to try and cover, as many different types as possible?
Well, yeah, I mean, the last thing I wanted to do was just sort of go over old ground, or just put a book out there that is in like a particular format. For example, I could have written a book where chapter one is the Loch Ness Monster, chapter two is this sea serpent, number three is Ogopogo, you know. But it's all been done, and I don't see the point of just going over old stuff, you know. The book's called Monsters of the Deep, and, you know, so it covers monsters in the waters, in the lakes, in the oceans, in the canals. But I wanted to sort of also address issues that a lot of people may not have known about. Like, for example, there's a significant number of reports in the UK of people seeing giant eels. When I say giant, I'm talking like 15, 16 feet long, you know, bodies with sort of almost like a, you know, a beer barrel kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, in one sense, you know, if you saw one of them coming at you, you know, on a Friday night coming out the canal, you probably wouldn't quibble that they were not a monster, you know. That clearly is a monster. But I also wanted to talk about the issue of how, you know, some monsters may actually be sort of escaped pets, you know, alligators that have become sort of too big, and, you know, these legends of alligators in the sewers in New York. So I wanted to cover just about everything that's weird and monstrous and that lives in the water, rather than just talking about Nessie. Is it a plesiosaur or whatever, plesiosaur or whatever? And I know you said earlier, you know, before we went on air, you know, you wanted to sort of talk a bit about some of the stories about the London Underground. Now, one of the things, when the publisher said, you know, the book's, you know, we can title the book Monsters of the Deep, and sometimes, you know, I thought this was a really good title, but sometimes, you know, I have big arguments with the publishers about the titles, because I don't feel that, you know, sometimes I'm like, no, can we just change it? That's just crap, you know. let's just make it a bit more eye-catching.
Yeah.
But I was glad they used Monsters of the Deep, because what I also said to the publisher, I was like, well, keep the deep in the book, because there's actually, you know, that can sort of focus on the oceans and lakes and things like that, but it can also involve underground areas as well. So we kind of kept it where I was able to put that angle as well into the book without it sort of seeming to be out of place. And to get back to the finally, you know, the that you were talking about, there are a lot of really weird stories related to mysteries in the London Underground. Now, certainly in you know, the world of fiction and movie entertainment and TV, you've got the sort of one of my favourite movies, which is Hammer Films, Quatermass and the Pit.
It's
my favourite movies. That's a really great movie, you know, of this ancient, funnily enough, ancient Martian craft which slams deep into the ground under London, but like centuries and literally centuries ago. You know, almost by proxy, if you like, the Martians are able to survive by sort of integrating themselves into our civilization by sort of genetically altering early humans. And you know, you've got the what was it called, that one where they find the dragons in the London Underground, and we all go to war against dragons.
Reign of Fire.
Yeah, Reign of Fire, that's the one. Yeah, I mean, that's another classic example. And then you know, you've got American Werewolf of London, another good one, you know, where you've got the werewolf prowling around the London subways. A lot of people don't know that there are a number of cases like this. In the 1930s, for example, a number of people went missing in a number also of the tube stations themselves. And several people talked about seeing the dressed in like loin kind of things, you know, as if they were sort of primitive humans, that kind of thing. Another one would be Raw Meat. The alternative name was Deathline.
Yes, the Christopher Lee film.
And you've got the American title for it and the UK title. And they deal with how, for example, a team back in the 1800s were building, this is part of the movie, I should say, not real story. But in the movie, you've got this situation where this team building one of the new tunnels in the late 1800s, and it collapses, and no one's able to get them out, and eventually people forget about them, and they sort of devolve into cannibals who, when they're hungry, you know, they'll grab one or two people off the tube station, and that'll be dinner for tonight, you know. And even there have been rumours along those lines. Now, one of the people I interviewed on this issue was actually a retired police officer, or policeman, I should say, named Frank Wiley. And I interviewed Frank probably 14 or 15 years ago, something like that. And he'd heard these stories. Now, just because he heard stories doesn't necessarily make them true, but I mean, in one sense, you know, it's a shame for the people, but it is a cool story.
Yes.
And but the fact is, you know, Frank told me that there were rumours that at some point in like the 50s or early 60s, that there were a sudden spate of people sort of vanishing or being killed in the underground systems in very weird and sinister situations.
Yeah.
And he said that although he wasn't sort of directly involved, he said he heard rumours of people sort of being plucked away, if you like, and that there was supposedly some sort of cover up, and you know, nobody really knew what had happened except for the fact that a number of people had vanished, and that the police were looking into it, and there were people who claimed to have seen, you know, these very primitive looking and hobo types, if you like. And a really weird story. I mean, the reason why I found it fascinating was mainly because he didn't sort of over-exaggerate the story. He said, well, I can tell you what I know, but it's sort of second-hand, or this was third-hand. But he was who he claimed to be. And when you've got somebody like that, you know, an old guy back then in his 80s, you know, when you've got something like that, it did impress me, even though it was a bizarre story. But I mean, a lot of those, well, not a lot, but I mean, some of those old tunnel systems, you know, they're sort of locked up now, you know, because they were used in the Second World War. They were either damaged, or in some cases, you know, a lot of old files from the government are still stored in some of those lower level areas. So, I mean, who's to say for sure what could be down there? But again, you know, it's not technically sort of Monsters of the Deep in the sense that it's all just lake monsters or canal monsters or whatever, but it also covers, you know, what could actually be deep below our feet.
Yeah. I think if you've ever used the London Underground, Nick, one of the most disconcerting feelings you can ever get is if you're used to the London Underground, if you get off at a station and there's nobody there.
It is
such a weird feeling because you're so used to it being so constantly busy. Wherever you are in London, I think most times of the week.
I think the last time I was on the London on the Underground was the last time I was in London, which was probably was about 20 years ago now. Mm. But you're right, it does have that kind of eerie, almost like, I don't know, like almost like 28 days later or something.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Where everybody's gone or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But it is, and particularly, you know, like at night, you get off those trains, and or if you're just on the trains, you know, and there's just one other person, you know, in your train, and you're like, you know, is that some sort of serial killer? But it's just some poor guy who's just missed his previous, train.
Yeah.
But he's probably thinking the same thing, you know.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, I'm always, because I've got a lot of friends who live in and around London, so I know it like the back of my hand. And there's a brilliant documentary that was done about 15 years ago called Ghosts on the Underground, Nick. Which is first hand. I'll send you the link later. It's brilliant.
Okay.
Somebody's put it on YouTube for all our benefits. Mm-hmm. And it was first hand interviews with London Underground staff who'd had paranormal encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are genuinely frightening. They really are. And there's a line in it where it basically says, well, next time you're on the train, maybe the person you can see along the carriage isn't actually a person, they're a ghost. And so now every time I'm on there, I'm just double checking, making sure. But it has its own atmosphere. And I think it's because you're so used to seeing it, a frenzy of excitement and noise and people. Whenever you don't have that, it just takes it to a whole different level.
No, you're right, and I think, you know, whether it's our sort of our psychological makeup, I think to a degree we're sort of fascinated by tunnels and caves and caverns. You know, they become almost sort of magical, kind of like with the Mars thing. You know, we're not really sure why, but we are sort of fascinated by things like that. And you know, that I think is why this issue of, you know, why so many movies are made about tunnels and caves and, you know, like The Descent and things like that, because people love like that kind of stuff. You know, I like that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And I mean, I'll give you another example as to how, you know, these sort of secret underground issues can go on. My dad spent his entire, apart from his national service in the Royal Air Force when he was a kid, he spent his working career as a carpenter.
Yeah.
And the company he worked for in the mid-1980s, they had won a contract to do some work at like a fitness centre in the town of Cannock in Staffordshire, which Staffordshire was where I grew up as a kid, just outside the city of Lichfield. And my dad worked on this one particular, it's called the Cannock Leisure Centre. And he was one of the guys who had to build these huge, thick doors on the lower level of the leisure centre. You've got like the surface area, and then you go down about 15 steps, 20 steps, and all the doors there were really thick doors. But it was just to a lower level where, you know, you could do all your exercise and whatever. And my dad told me, he took me there, but he said I was a kid then. I was probably about 19 when he told me about this, 18, something like that. And he took me in there and he said, do you know why those doors there are so thick? And I said no, and he said, well, although it is a leisure centre, if there was ever a nuclear attack, it would actually be converted to the best thing they could do to create like a bunker for the local council to try and continue some sort of degree of society and sort of run it from deep below the second floor of the leisure centre. And I actually did a blog post on that. I'll send you the link, and you'll see the picture where my dad was standing. You know, and you can see him standing next to these doors, which the doors are like 14 inches thick, you know, which you don't need in your average leisure centre.
Yeah.
No, he said, and he told me you know, the local council said, you know, don't go talking about it. There was no, like, sort of Men in Black or the government coming in or MI5. It was just, but it was a case of, you know, just don't talk about it. It's because it's due, you know, it's going to be, if there was a nuclear war, that would be the emergency place, and that's why we want you to build the doors. So, yeah, but I'll, when we get off, or tomorrow, I'll send you the link. And but again, you know, this is sort of a case of underground mysteries right in front of your eyes, you know. The building, you drive past work every day, you know, the swimming centre and the, you know.
Yes, yeah, it is. I think, like you say, though, Nick, it is something about the underground, or be it a tunnel or a cave or wherever, because obviously where I grew up, Yorkshire, was obviously mining country. So the majority of my family spent a considerable period of their working lives underground, Nick, which is remarkable when we think about it this day and age.
Yeah.
Large swathes of the working population of Britain and other countries around the world would spend up to 12 hours a day in pitch black darkness. And there's a couple of wonderful books that somebody wrote about some of the incidents of people that had unusual encounters underground in pits, usually meeting deceased miners in various areas. But it was often one of those things that I remember my grandfather used to tell me a story that there'd been a terrible accident, because obviously they used to use some, you know, pretty hefty machinery underground, trying to get hold of the seams and stuff, and some of the clearing equipment was enormous. And there was a particular incident where some poor gentleman got stuck between a coal face and one of the boring machines, Nick, and was obviously killed. And then within about a month of it happening, obviously they'd because usually they'd leave it for a couple of days, clean it all up, and then they'd just carry on, which is also remarkable that they would have that kind of attitude. But I suppose everybody had to in those days just to get the job done. And they would often claim after about a month that people's sandwiches would always disappear, and this particular miner was known for always forgetting his dinner, and he'd nab sandwiches off people. So, and he would often say he would always take an extra sandwich.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I'm sure there's so many sort of classic, you know, tales of things underground, you know. And again, it just sort of resonates with us, you know, the idea of mysteries and secrets below your feet, you know. I mean, one of my favourite movies that really sort of gets to the heart of that is not a horror movie or anything like that at all, but I think it really gets to the heart of why we're fascinated by all this kind of stuff and the kind of secrecy angle. I don't know if you've ever seen it's a 1987 movie called Hidden City.
No, I've never seen that, no.
Oh, well, it stars Charles Dance. And it also stars, if you ever watched Lovejoy.
Yes.
One of the other characters is the guy who plays Eric.
Yes, I know what you mean.
But Hidden City, I won't give away the story because it'll disappoint it for you. Mm. But basically, it's a man and a young girl who, due to various circumstances, find themselves deep in the tunnels and everything else deep below London. So if you ever get to see Hidden City, it's a really interesting and sort of cool movie.
Fantastic. I'll certainly add that.
Or I should say film, not movie.
Yeah, it's all right, don't worry. Hey, we're not that precious about these terms these days, Nick. Well, listen, thank you so much as always, my friend, for joining
all right,
in and chatting with me. Where can everybody keep up to date and get a hold of a copy of your latest work, Nick?
Well, I have an Amazon page, so just go for Amazon for Nick Redfern, and it'll take you to my Amazon page. And I have a blog called World of Whatever, and you can also find me, just type my name in Facebook, and people have got questions they might have, or if they want to share an experience that they might be looking for answers for, you know, I'm always happy to help people. So.
Yeah, and usually a daily article on Mysterious Universe as well, Nick.
That's right.
Yep. Prolific as ever. So what's next, Mr. Redfern? What can we expect you to be delving into on your next publication?
Well, the next one, which I should have the book actually finished round about midway through January. It's like it's done in chapter style, but it's pretty much like an A to Z of everything to do with time travel. So it covers, you know, the different theories and you know, what are timelines, you know, what's the speed of light, that kind of thing. It's sort of where you can kind of like Monsters of the Deep.
Yes.
Instead of having sort of like multiple long chapters, you know, you've got like a little, you know, some nuggets here and a nugget there on this different thing or whatever. So
Oh, fantastic. So hopefully that'll be the first release of the new year then.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably be the end of January when I hand it over to the publisher. Then there'll be like a month of all the hassles. Nick, what does this mean? What's that? And
then, arguing about the title.
And then they'll put the you know, the cover together, and then it has to go to, you know, the printer, and then it gets asked to send out to the publisher. So it's probably going to be probably April, I would say, something like that. So it's still a few months. It's going to be 4 or 5 months away, which is probably a long time for me. You know, I try and get them out closer than that. But the people who, you know, who like my books, hopefully they won't sort of get withdrawal symptoms, you know, if it is going to be sort of April or May. But but I guess, you know, it's again, it's just one of those situations. So.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, I look forward to that, as I always do with anything you publish, Nick. So
cheers, mate.
Yeah, you're very welcome. As always, like I say, thank you again for your time. You take care, and if I don't get a chance to speak to you again before, have a great Christmas.
You too, Paul. Thanks a lot.